Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
On today's podcast, we'll be discussing the recent international crisis brewing in eastern Ukraine after Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 was allegedly shot down by separatist rebels in the area. The incident represents one of the biggest air tragedies in recent history, actually the second one for Malaysian Airlines this year. Listeners might recall the MH370 mystery from earlier in the year when a Malaysian Airlines flight vanished over the South China Sea with all of its passengers, including about 180 Chinese passengers. But anyways, focusing on MH17, this flight was en route from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, carrying mostly Dutch citizens, a few other Europeans, Australians, and some Malaysians. One U.S. citizen was on board, and the flight was actually intercepted and shot down by allegedly Ukrainian separatist rebels, is what most people think at this point. All passengers and the crew, all 298 of them, perished in the crash. And right now, this has turned into a huge international crisis. Intelligence agencies in the West and Ukraine are trying to substantiate the degree to which Russia, which backs the separatists in eastern Ukraine, was involved with this incident. Because if it does turn out that the Russian government provided any sort of material intelligence or radar assistance to the rebels in this particular circumstance, that could turn into a huge crisis for Putin and Russia. So, Zach, I mean, so you wrote a piece about who could have possibly shot this down. So, I mean, it seems pretty clear to me at this point that, you know, there's a lot of evidence supporting the hypothesis that this was the separatists in Ukraine and not the Ukrainian government or, in fact, the Russian military on the other hand.
Yeah, well, when I wrote the piece, that was the conclusion I basically came to. But this was – when I wrote it, it was still somewhat more in the air. I think right now it's pretty well established it was the separatists, and as you said, the main thing to figure out is what kind of Russian support they got. Apparently, the missile system they shot down, I believe, had been captured from the Ukraine forces when they took over the parts of eastern Ukraine that they control. But, so that was kind of I actually assumed it probably was a Russian anti-aircraft missile system. But so apparently it was Ukrainian, and so the real damning evidence potentially for Russia is if the radar that Russia or Russian agents helped them learn to use the system, and if they provided radar to help to guide the missile. So I've remained somewhat skeptical that the radar was really being run by the Russians, because I feel like, and Anka, I'd like to see what you thought about this. Like, it seems to me that the radar system that Russia has, and if it was being operated by Russian agents, that they would be able to distinguish between a civilian and a military aircraft, right? What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the big mystery here. I mean, so earlier, you know, I saw a picture that was making the rounds on Twitter of the actual control panel off one of these Buke launchers. And you have to, you know, think that with the number of buttons and panels and everything, I mean, if you're an untrained Ukrainian militia member who's essentially fighting the government here, you're not trained in operating this sort of an anti-air platform. This is a very sophisticated system intended for highly trained military use. It's very difficult to actually operate one of these systems independent of an ISR support system. So I think it's highly unlikely that what happened here was actually these untrained rebels captured one of these Ukrainian Buke systems and then set it up to shoot down a civilian aircraft. I mean, so before this incident happened, I believe the rebels had succeeded in shooting down two Ukrainian military transports. I believe they were Antonov AN-26 transports.
Well, one of them was a transport and one was a fighter jet from what I read.
Oh, yeah, well, the fighter jet, I believe, was shot down the morning of the MH17, and that was allegedly by Russian forces. That news actually was huge, but then it got completely swallowed by the MH17 story. But I think that's also interesting. We should go back to discussing that. But so, you know, one of the things that I mentioned in my initial report was the leader of the rebels, Igor Strelkov. I mean, he went to social media and bragged about, on the morning of the MH17 tragedy, that the separatists had succeeded in shooting down an AN-26. So what happened here, it seems, is that there was no intention to shoot down a civilian aircraft. It was essentially they thought that they were shooting down a military transport plane, but it turned out that they ended up shooting down this Malaysian Airlines flight. But, you know, I mean, that's the big question. Like, if they had Russian support, you'd assume that a highly trained Russian military radio operator would be able to tell that the transponder signal indicated that this was a civilian aircraft. So I don't know how to square that here. I mean, it could be that Russia has, we know that Russia has sort of, you know, ununiformed soldiers essentially operating with these rebels in eastern Ukraine. So it could be that, you know, one of them managed to figure out how to operate this. But at this point, I mean, this is all speculation.
Well, I don't know. I think the Ukraine rebels could very well have been trained, I think. Some, not all of them, obviously, but some of them could have been trained to use these because Ukraine military, I believe, operates these systems. And a lot of these people could have been part of the Ukraine military until the old government was overthrown, in which case they defected to the rebels because they were loyal to the former Ukrainian government. So they were like from eastern Ukraine, and they had been in the security forces of Ukraine during the – I forget the former leader's name now that was overthrown earlier this year. So, I mean, I don't think it's completely implausible that Ukrainian rebels have military experience from before the Civil War that would give them some knowledge of how to use these systems. If – and the other point is that specifically because like – what they thought they shot down apparently was a military transport plane, and Ukraine was flying these transport planes and its fire jets from very low altitudes compared to the civilian aircraft. So it seems like someone who shot it down either did it intentionally or more likely was inept enough or knew enough to be able to operate the system but wasn't very good at it because it couldn't distinguish if it was a civilian aircraft despite the different transponder signals and the fact that it was flying at a huge altitude. So, I mean, it does seem like it was they personally had rudimentary skills in operating the system.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right that the Ukrainian military, you know, does have experience with these systems. I mean, actually, you know, you go back to 2001, the Ukrainian military actually ended up accidentally shooting down a Russian aircraft. Siberian Airlines Flight 1812 in 2001 ended up killing a bunch of Russian citizens, and essentially it was just an errant missile fired during a military exercise. So, I mean, it's clear that, you know, former Ukrainian troops are with these rebels, and they have some experience there. So that's, again, an explanation. But I think it's incredibly important to establish if and to what degree Russia was involved with this. I mean, because they backed the rebels, there's been a lot of criticism of Putin for his position here. And if it turns out that there was material support from the Russian military, that's going to be damning for Russia. And I think it's really going to have important geopolitical ramifications for how the European Union reacts proposals for greater sanctions on Russia from the United States. I mean, I think that's really going to change the equation here.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely can. But before we can move to that, can I actually ask real quick, do we know if like there's any possibility that the rebels captured the radar system for the anti-aircraft missile? The radars or would, because that would be a key piece of evidence. If it was a Russian-supplied radar, then they could definitely tie it to Russia. But if it was something that the Ukrainians rebels captured themselves, that would again maybe allow Russia to escape. Do you know the answer to that by any chance?
Yeah, I mean, so I don't know the answer to that definitively, but I think so the Pentagon has actually been I think they announced this morning that most of the evidence that the United States has gathered points to the fact that this was the separatists independent of Russia. So I think that you know, there might be evidence that they actually did manage to acquire a radar system, if not the precise radar system that is supposed to operate in conjunction with the Buk missile system. It could be another radar system that would have allowed them to at least, you know, make this shot on this aircraft. I think that's highly likely as well.
Either way, I think, though, it doesn't even really matter. If it was the rebels operating independently, I still think this turns out bad for Russia geopolitically, and I think it's going to increase pressure on Putin to kind of pull back. And there's already some reason for him to do so. It doesn't really look like the rebels are going to be particularly successful at conquering any large part of Ukraine. So I think there was some – basically Putin was basically using these continued rebel holdouts as leverage against the new Ukrainian government to sort of get them to temper their leaning to the West and retaining Russian influence. So I think that this just kind of – I mean, the Ukrainian government's obviously going to use this to try to convince Europe and the U.S. for greater support and rooting out the rebels and taking down Russia. And I mean, I think the – Europeans, especially the Dutch, since they lost many citizens, are going to be anxious to do so as well. And I think it just increases pressure on everyone to put more pressure on Russia, and it obviously increases Russia to pull back support for the Ukrainian rebels.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Putin's response was, you know, he expressed his condolences to the Malaysian prime minister and obviously to, you know, everyone else. And he essentially blamed Ukraine. I mean, he said that it was the Ukrainian government's fault for allowing these sort of conditions to exist within its territory. And he's called for negotiations, which is, you know, very typical at this point. But, you know, that was the only thing he could have done here. I mean, I really, you know, want to see how Putin is going to react. I mean, if evidence is found that there was actual Russian involvement here, I mean, what's your, you know, how do you think, you know, that would play out?
Not well for Russia. you know, I think it was definitely the level three sanctions that the U.S. started adding earlier this week, and I think Europe was supposed to. I mean, I think those would be expanded. I mean, I just think it would just – I think it would be bad for Russia's dealings, like, with every country. I mean, because no one – no country really wants to see, you know, civilian airliners shot down.
Yeah.
So I think – but, I mean, other – this has happened before to other – I mean, the U.S. shot down on a – the U.S.
Iranian,
military
yeah.
shot down an Iranian aircraft in the, during the tanker war. So, I mean, I don't think it's going to be, like, necessarily lead to a full-on war between Russia and the West by any means. I've seen
yeah.
some people suggesting that this – you know, wars have started over lesser
– No.
You know, I don't see that happening. What do you?
I don't see that happening either. It's actually interesting. I mean, the U.S. shooting down the Iranian aircraft, the death toll in that incident was actually just one more than this incident. So they're very comparable in that sense. But that was, you know, obviously was a major incident between the U.S. and Iran and essentially colored their diplomacy for a long time afterwards. I mean, this could turn out similarly for Russia. And I think it would be in the, you know, a bit of a nail in the coffin for Russia in terms of its international isolation after all that Putin's gone through this year. I mean, I feel like for Putin, you know, he really wants to win in Ukraine right now. I mean, he wants these rebels to succeed. He wants to hang on to Crimea. And this is, I mean, there's a lot on the line here.
Yeah, well, I think basically, I don't really see him having much more territorial gains, at least in the short term, in Ukraine. I think it's kind of clear he knows that it's going to be hard to take and control more territory. So I think he wants to protect Crimea as being part of Russia. And I think he also wants just continue to put pressure on the Ukrainian government so that and just disrupt its operations to basically make it more likely that, you know, pro-Russian government might take hold again as they did after the Orange Revolution, and then basically make sure that the current Ukrainian government doesn't lean too far to the West and become too anti-Russian. So I think he's more using these rebels for leverage at this point rather than like as a means to start taking more and more territory from Ukraine. But I could be wrong. I mean, I have no idea. You know, speculation, of course.
Absolutely. Yeah, Putin plays his cards close to his chest, as we know.
This could be – the one silver line that could come from this incident is – I mean, there's obviously a lot of countries, Russia, Iran, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, a lot of different countries that support these non-state groups that are basically proxies. I think this kind of just goes to show that you know, you should be careful doing that to other countries because it could really turn out – you know, it could really come back to bite you.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, this is also a lesson in some ways for, you know, why the United States and Syria decided to keep its form of aid to the non-lethal variety. I mean, even though, you know, this wasn't a Russian-provided missile system, I mean, the Russians have been providing weapons to these rebels, essentially enabling them to stick it out this long against the Ukrainian government.
Yeah, that's really the point.
It's very difficult to control unpredictable rebel groups. I mean, even if you're using them as a proxy, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, even Putin's been calling, at least, you know, tentatively for a ceasefire, and the separatist forces rejected Putin's call for negotiations or whatever, and this could have been coordinated, but it's possible that he's just, you know, it's most likely that Russia can't completely control these rebels, and I think that the key point here is that even if this turns out to be a Ukrainian, you know, a system that the rebels acquired from the Ukrainian military, and there is no direct Russian involvement, it just shows that if you support, you know, non-state actors, you're going to be held somewhat accountable for what they do, regardless if you were actually the one directing that particular action. So I think it's a lesson for – I think the great example that you had was – I mean, the Syria example is great, I think. You know, the U.S. – you know, because the U.S. is considering increasing its aid right now by a lot to its rebels, and it should give the U.S. pause, hopefully, in doing that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, on the flip side, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries have been providing lethal aid for a while, and that's why the Syrian conflict has essentially spiraled out of control in many ways. But I think, you know, that's a totally separate discussion in terms of how much control a country can expect to have over the rebels in another place. But let's talk a bit about, you know, the Asian angle to this, because, you know, we are here as a diplomat. So, you know, what do you think of the implications for, you know, Sino-Russian ties after this? I mean, so this is very different from the Malaysian Airlines 370 crisis, which was, you know, 150 Chinese perished in that, and there was obviously a huge nationalist backlash against that accident. But here, I mean, there wasn't a single Chinese citizen on board, and China's been kind of playing its cards close to its chest again on the Ukraine issue. Do you think this will change anything major between Russia and China?
No, it doesn't seem like it will. You know, we were talking when this first happened yesterday, kind of. We thought it would... would probably have significant ramifications because we, based on like MH370, you know, we thought there'd be a ton of Chinese. There's potentially a bunch of Chinese citizens on board, and if that was the case, you know, I think it would have affected, you know, Russian relations because, you know, China, there'd be pressure from nationalistic audiences in China for the government to do something. So I think that would have, it definitely seemed like it was going to affect them. But since there wasn't any really Chinese citizens on board, I don't really see it having much impact. I think China will probably just kind of take a, you know, condemn, they'll say it was a tragedy, it condemns shooting down civilian planes, but I don't see it really having any lasting impact. What about you?
Yeah. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, just for listeners, like the foreign ministry statement from China was pretty predictable. I mean, they said, we are shocked at the crash of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17. And essentially they expressed their condolences and sincere sympathy. And that was pretty much it. And they hoped that the causes would be found out as soon as possible. So, you know, they're apparently on board for the investigation here. And I think that's what everybody is waiting for. I think what's more interesting maybe in Asia geopolitically with this incident is Japan and Russia.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's something definitely worth talking about because, you know, Shinzo Abe in 2013 made a huge attempt at renewing Japan's diplomacy with Russia, not just over the issue of the Kuril Islands, but also for, you know, liquid natural gas provisions from Russia to Japan. And then essentially after the Ukraine crisis, Japan has kind of been towing the line between its commitments and alliances in the West and its relationship with Russia. So, you know, I think this is definitely going to be a difficult place for Abe. I mean, I think he's going to have to turn away from Russia again if it turns out that they were involved in this in any real way.
Yeah, I mean, Japan definitely had an interest in seeing tensions die down in Ukraine. He said, I can't remember exactly when it was, a month or two ago, that he still thinks that he still intends on, you know, having Putin come visit Japan in this fall, I think October or something. But, you know, if this significantly escalates things, especially if it's proved that Russia was directly involved, I mean, it's going to make it very difficult for him to continue trying to, you know, mount a charm offensive towards Russia and significantly reduce tensions. It's also worth noting that the most recent data about Japan scrambling jets has shown that Japan's continued increasing the amount of jets it's had to scramble due to Russian aircraft entering into its airspace or coming close to it in recent months. So there was, even though this charm offensive going on, there has been some low-level tensions building between Russia and Japan. I think this, if Russia's involved, it's just going to make Abe have to kind of confront that more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we'll see Japan take a very different position on its Russian diplomacy soon, if it does turn out that Russia was involved here.
In that way, that could be the biggest influence it has for China, or the biggest impact that's for China, in that, I mean, this charm offensive towards Russia from Japan was based on basically you know, creating a rift between China and Russia, or basically trying to reduce China's influence. Japan sees Russia as a potentially important actor in balancing against China. So I think that to the point it causes a rift between Japan and Russia, that's to the benefit of China.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure I actually, you know, agree with Japan's policy in there. I mean, I think, like, you know, Abe's got a long way to go to make China and Russia split apart. It's going to take a lot more than, you know, Kuril Islands issue and liquid natural gas and what else have you.
Oh, no doubt, but I think that to the point, like, for instance, I don't think necessarily split apart, but I think it can reduce China's influence in Russia in that, like,
okay,
if Russia can send natural gas to Japan and South Korea, then it becomes less reliant completely on sending it to China, so it can potentially, you know, if there's disputes over, say, the Far East Russia, then, like, Russia would be less apprehensive about you know, coming out against China. So I think basically it's just to make sure that China or Russia doesn't become another tributary state to China.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks a lot for listening. And we'll be back next week with more on the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.